The Ministry of Culture smelled of damp wool and stale tobacco, an institutional stench that no amount of polishing could disguise. Vera pushed through the heavy glass doors at 8:30, her scarf wrapped twice around her neck despite the mild morning, because the corridors were always cold and she had learned to dress for the building's mood rather than the weather outside. The soldiers in greatcoats had not returned. Instead, a clerk she did not recognize sat at the reception desk, reading a newspaper with the detached air of a man who believed the news applied to him. He looked up when she entered, adjusted his glasses, and went back to reading. She took the stairs. The elevator had been working until last week, or perhaps the week before she had stopped keeping careful track and the ministry's maintenance man, a solid man named Franta, who used to complain about the temperature settings with genuine enthusiasm, had not appeared at his post since Tuesday. The fluorescent lights overhead hummed with a frequency that made her teeth ache. On the second floor landing, someone had taped a notice to the wall. A typed memorandum from the deputy minister regarding updated procedures for personal correspondence and foreign publications. Vera did not stop to read it. She had seen similar notices posted in the stairwells of every government building she had ever worked in, notices that promised efficiency and transparency while quietly reorganizing the architecture of suspicion. Her office waited on the fourth floor, room 412, a space she had inhabited for 4 years. The desk label a small brass rectangle stamped with her name and title had peeled off sometime during the weekend and lay curled beneath the edge of the desk, its adhesive exhausted. She picked it up, turned it over in her hands, and slipped it into her coat pocket. It was a habit born of months of uncertainty, involving the collection of small detritus, a torn page from a ministry form, a broken pencil, a rubber band that had lost its snap. She told herself it was practical, that she might need them, but she did not admit the truth. She liked holding the evidence of decay in her palm because it made the abstract feel manageable. The typewriter on her desk was covered with a layer of dust that had settled while she was busy surviving. She ran her finger along the edge and left a clean line in the gray. Behind the typewriter, a stack of manuscripts weighted translations she had completed in September and October, before the tanks, before the sky turned gray with smoke, before the ministry announced that all foreign publications required renewed approval. These were innocent texts, a collection of Czech children's poems translated from German, a technical manual on agricultural machinery, a literary journal article about the influence of Russian formalism on post-war Czech poetry. None of them contained coded messages. None of them referenced anything except their subjects. But the ministry did not distinguish between innocent and guilty anymore. It distinguished between compliant and non-compliant, and compliance was measured not by what you said, but by whom you knew. The door opened at 9:15. It was not a colleague. It was a woman Vera recognized from the acquisitions department, a sharp-faced woman in her 40s who wore her hair in a severe bun and spoke in clipped syllables that sounded like stamps hitting paper. She carried a cardboard box the size of a shoebox, the kind of box used for archiving personnel files, and she set it down on the desk opposite Vera's with a thud that made the typewriter keys shift. "You've heard," Petra said. "It was not a question." Vera shook her head. "I haven't." "They're calling it a review of staffing qualifications." Petra's mouth tightened. She did not sit down. She never sat down in the ministry. She stood at angles like a blade held ready. "They're calling it necessary. They're calling it a matter of national security." She paused, as if expecting Vera to fill in the blanks to show that she understood the language being spoken here. "They want everyone in the main hall at 10, all departments, everyone who hasn't been sent home already." "What for?" Petra's eyes flicked toward the window, toward the gray light that fell across the desks and the filing cabinets and the potted plant that had died 3 months ago and nobody had removed. "To hear the announcements, to hear who stays and who goes." She adjusted the strap of her bag on her shoulder. "I wouldn't wait for the meeting if I were you, Vera. I'd go home and pack. Quietly." "Why, what did I do?" Petra looked at her then, really looked at her, and for a moment Vera saw something that might have been sympathy or might have been the exhaustion of a woman who had spent 20 years learning that sympathy got you suspended. "It's not what you did," Petra said. "It's who you're associated with." She turned and walked out, her footsteps quick and precise on the linoleum, the sound of someone who believed that speed could outrun consequences. Vera sat very still. The dust on her desk continued to settle. Through the wall, she could hear the muffled clatter of a colleague's typewriter. Somebody else, in some other room, still typing as if the world had not changed. She thought of Jiri. She thought of the satchel beneath the floorboards. She thought of the way her thumb throbbed faintly, the scab catching on the desk's wooden edge when she rested her hand flat. At 9:30, the first of her own colleagues appeared. Old Mr. Kopicki, who had worked in the poetry division since 1952, and who brought a thermos of tea to every morning like a ritual of defiance, shuffled into her office with his coat buttoned wrong, his eyes wide and watery behind thick spectacles. He stopped in the doorway and stared at her for a long moment, as if trying to place her in a category that would determine whether he should speak to her or avoid her. "Vera," he said finally, his voice was thin, papery. I heard about the American." She said nothing. "I didn't know," he said quickly, the words tumbling out like stones from a pocket. "I didn't know about him, about the meetings, at the cafe. I swear to God, Vera, I didn't know." He gripped the thermos with both hands, his knuckles white. "I only saw you talking. Once, maybe twice, I thought perhaps you were discussing a translation. Perhaps he was a source. I didn't think." He stopped. He looked at the floor. He looked at the ceiling. He looked anywhere but at her. "I hope they don't," he turned and left, closing the door softly behind him, the way he closed everything. Gently, apologetically, as if the world were made of glass and he was afraid of breaking it. By 9:50, three more people had passed through her office or stopped in the corridor to exchange glances that said everything and nothing. A young woman from the indexing department, no older than Vera herself, lingered in the doorway with her arms crossed tightly over her chest, her lips pressed into a line so thin it was almost invisible. She did not speak. She simply looked at Vera with an expression that was neither hostile nor sympathetic, but something worse, recognition. She recognized the shape of what was happening because she had felt it coming in her own body, the slow sinking of dread that begins in the stomach and spreads outward until it reaches the fingertips. Then she nodded once, sharply, and walked away. Vera began to pack. She did not know what she was packing for. She did not know if she would be allowed to return tomorrow, or next week, or next year. She took the photograph from the desk drawer, the one dated 1964, the one of her mother standing in front of the printer's shop, smiling with a certainty that Vera had not felt since she was a girl. She slid it into her coat pocket beside the brass label. She took the rubber stamps from the drawer and placed them in a neat row on the desktop, her name, her title, the ministry seal. She did not put them in the box. She left them where they were, as if leaving them might somehow signal that she intended to come back and use them again. The typewriter ribbon was fraying. She noticed this for the first time, running her eye along the line of a sentence she had been drafting that morning, a routine translation of a ministry bulletin about grain quotas, and seeing how the letters faded toward the end, as if the ink itself had grown tired. She pressed the carriage return, and the ribbon snagged, leaving a streak of black across the page. She tore the page out and threw it in the waste basket, next to a stack of other pages that had been rejected for reasons she could no longer remember. At 10 o'clock, the corridor filled with footsteps. People emerged from their offices like survivors of a collapse, moving toward the stairs with the careful deliberation of those who expected something to fall on them at any moment. Vera joined them, falling into the flow without deciding to join. The stairwell echoed with voices low, urgent, the kind of conversations that happened in whispers even when no one was listening. She caught fragments as she descended. "They took Delansky this morning. Not just the Westerners, they're checking everyone, even the ones who. My name was on a list, I don't know whose list, I don't want to know. Petra from acquisitions already gone, they called her in at 9. She came out with a box and she didn't even look at me." Vera kept her eyes forward. She kept her hands at her sides. She kept her breathing even, the way she kept her translations even, line by line, word by word, never looking at the whole page until the work was done. The main hall was a large room on the ground floor, all concrete walls and high ceilings, lit by a single row of fluorescent tubes that buzzed like trapped insects. It was the kind of room designed for speeches, for ceremonies, for the projection of authority. Today it held 200 people, standing shoulder to shoulder in the damp chill, their faces pale and drawn, their coats and scarves creating a mosaic of muted colors gray, brown, navy, black that blended together until they were indistinguishable. The air smelled of wet wool and nervous sweat, and the faint metallic tang of fear. At the far end of the hall, a podium had been set up with a microphone that crackled intermittently, producing bursts of static that made people flinch. Behind the podium, a banner hung from the wall, a ministry emblem, the stylized wheat stalk and hammer, rendered in red paint that had begun to peel at the edges. Below the emblem, a typed sign read, "Review of staffing qualifications, all personnel attend." Nobody spoke. 200 people stood in silence and waited for the microphone to stop crackling. When it did, the voice that came through was Colonel Hansel's. It was calm, measured, the voice of a man who had rehearsed this speech a dozen times and knew exactly where each pause should fall. He spoke in Czech, in the polished bureaucratic register that made threats sound like administrative procedures. He spoke about loyalty and responsibility, about the need to examine the professional qualifications of personnel in light of recent developments, about the ministry's commitment to maintaining the integrity of its mission in these challenging times. He did not mention names. He did not need to. The names would come later, in individual summonses, in whispered conversations in stairwells, in the small cardboard boxes that people carried out of their offices at various hours throughout the morning. Vera listened with her face blank, with her body still, with her mind racing through a calculation she had been dreading since the tanks appeared on Karlova Ulus. How many associations did they know about? How many people had they interviewed? How much had Jiri said in the cafe, in the moments before the soldiers came, before he handed her the satchel, and told her that paper was heavier than lead? She had never told anyone about Jiri's meetings. She had never written his name in any document that the ministry could access. But names circulated in Prague the way information did through corridors, through cafes, through the mouths of people who believed that sharing knowledge made them part of something important, who did not understand that in a surveillance state, every conversation was a confession waiting to be filed. Hansel's voice continued, steady and patient, like a doctor explaining a diagnosis that everyone already knew but needed to hear from someone in authority. He spoke of reviews and evaluations, of temporary suspensions pending further investigation, of the ministry's willingness to restore positions to those who demonstrated sufficient commitment to the institution's values. He did not raise his voice. He did not need to. The silence that followed his speech was louder than any shout. Then he began to read names. Not all at once. Not dramatically. He read them slowly, one at a time, pausing between each to allow the person to step forward, to collect the slip of paper that would serve as their suspension notice, to walk out of the hall with their dignity intact, or in whatever fragments remained after the first cut. The names came in alphabetical order, as if this were a roll call, as if the ministry were conducting a routine attendance check rather than dismantling the lives of people who had dedicated decades to its work. Vera watched the people around her react to each name. Some stepped forward immediately, their faces composed, their movements deliberate. Others hesitated, looking around as if searching for an escape route, for a colleague who might vouch for them, for a sign that the process had made a mistake. A few did not move at all, standing frozen in place, as if their bodies had decided that movement would confirm what the words had already established. She counted the names, she counted the people, she counted the minutes, and she waited for her own name. It did not come. He adjusted the microphone, cleared his throat, and spoke again, his voice still calm, still measured. He said they could return to their desks. He said further reviews would follow. He folded his papers into a neat stack, squared them against the edge of the podium, and stepped back from the microphone as if he had finished something routine in inventory, a weather report, the reading of bus schedules. The hall exhaled. 200 people exhaled at once, a sound like wind moving through a corridor. Some people began to move toward the exits. Some remained, staring at the podium, at Hansel, at the banner with its peeling red paint. Some collapsed into chairs that had not been there a moment before, as if their legs had finally decided they could no longer support them. Vera stood still. Her name had not been called. Not today, she should have felt relief. Instead, she felt the cold certainty of someone who understands that the first cut is always the shallowest, that the ministry does not strike all at once, that it prefers to wound incrementally, to bleed people slowly so that they do not have time to organize their resistance. She had bought time, not freedom. and time in Prague in 1968 was the most expensive currency of all. She turned and walked toward the stairs. Her steps were steady. Her breathing was even. Her hand rested on the wall beside her, her fingers tracing the rough concrete, feeling the cold seep into her skin, anchoring her to the present moment, to this corridor, to this building, to this life that was being dismantled one name at a time. Behind her in the hall, she heard a woman's voice sharp, desperate, rising above the murmur of departing colleagues. It was Petra Svobodova. She was speaking to someone, to no one, to the empty air, her words cutting through the humidity of the hall like a blade. "They'll come for the rest of us," she said. "They'll come for the rest of us, and we'll stand here and wait for our names, and we'll hope it's not today, and we'll be wrong." Vera did not turn back. She climbed the stairs, one flight at a time, past the notice on the second floor landing, past the potted plant that had died, past her office door where the typewriter ribbon still snagged and the rubber stamp still waited on the desktop, and up to the fourth floor, where her desk held the evidence of things falling apart and her coat pocket held a photograph from 1964 and a brass label whose adhesive had given up. She collected her coat from the hook by the door. She took the photograph from her pocket and placed it on the desk, face up, next to the rubber stamps. She looked at her mother's smile for a moment at the certainty, at the ignorance, at the joy of a woman who believed that the world was organized and that her place in it was fixed and that nothing would change. Then she turned off the light and closed the door behind her, the way she closed everything. Gently, apologetically, as if the world were made of glass and she was afraid of breaking it. The corridor was empty now. The fluorescent lights hummed. Somewhere below, a typewriter began to clatter again, somebody else starting over, somebody else pretending that the work could continue as if nothing had happened. Vera walked toward the stairs, her hand on the wall, her thumb pressing against the rough concrete, the scab catching, the skin around it red and tender, the pain small and specific and real in a morning that had become entirely abstract. She descended. She pushed through the glass doors. She stepped into the November light, which was gray and thin and barely warm, and she walked toward the tram stop, toward the old town, toward the apartment above the printer's shop, toward the floorboards and the cavity and the satchel that waited beneath them, heavy with paper, heavy with truth, heavy with everything she had not yet decided whether to save or surrender. The tram passed, the fog swallowed it, Prague held its breath. She left the loose board undisturbed, pressing her weight against the seam until it clicked back into place, sealing the damp dark once more.